This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
With David Canfield.
Hello.
And joining us for the first and certainly not the last time, our new Hollywood correspondent, Natalie Jarvie.
Hi.
Natalie, thank you so much for letting us kind of throw you right onto the podcast because you have joined Vanity Fair at a time of great upheaval in the streaming service world, which is something you know a whole lot about. So you're going to come on and tell us the deal with HBO Max in a minute. So we're very grateful. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the rest of the show, we have festival news to talk about. Still, we have awards news to talk about. And we're going to look ahead toward festival season a little bit more now that the lineups are more or less complete and make some bold-ish predictions about maybe who we'll see at the Oscars in 6 months, because we love making bold predictions that turn out to be dramatically wrong months later. But first, Natalie, let's turn back to you. I'd have wanted to have you on to talk about HBO Max for a while now because, you know, it's been a few weeks since the great Twitter meltdown that had me, like, looking up to see if they had canceled HBO Max entirely, and they hadn't. Just people were writing obituaries for it way too early. But there is just still this constant drip of news of them removing Sesame Street episodes from the platform and canceling various programming areas. At this point now, as we record this, the week of August 23rd, is the HBO Max chaos just still ongoing? Is it still as unpredictable for their future as it was a few weeks ago?
Yeah, well, you know, HBO Max really helped spice up a otherwise slow August. and I think it will continue, maybe in a slow drip. They seem to be continuing to remove shows from the platform, and it's kind of happening on their own whim, I think. So it's a little unclear when it will stop and what point things will kind of return to normal.
I mean, I think anyone who looks at the financials can see, like, oh, they needed to cut corners. They don't want to lay a ton of people off, although they have laid people off. So, like, why not remove shows that are underperforming and are costing them some amount of money? But I think the question for those of us who aren't maybe financial experts is, like, is all this bad PR worth it? What do you think, Natalie?
It's a really good question, because you're right. These are shows that people weren't watching. They weren't talking about. But the removal of these shows from the platform is making people very upset and anxious about it. And in some cases, I think drumming up some excitement for things like Vinyl, which, you know, didn't have a big audience when it actually was airing. David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery, is in a really tough spot. He wants to show Hollywood that he is a friend to them, that he is going to be a good partner to them in his new role. But this is not helping him in his relationships with showrunners, with creators. It's making them very anxious about the future of their shows on a major streaming platform.
Yeah, I mean, David and Rebecca, you and I are on, like, you know, phone calls with the reps who are behind all these awards movies at this point. And I think that gives us a really clear insight into when you have an awards campaign, like, that's all about showing money and support for filmmakers. And it just feels like all this news out of HBO Max and Warner's in the last couple weeks has been the opposite. Do you guys see that hurting them in the future, too?
I'm curious to talk to people at the Emmys, I think. That'll be one of the first opportunities where a lot of people with HBO Max shows will be in the room. I feel like a lot of creatives are probably taking a sort of wait and see how this all plays out, because right now it does feel like so much is kind of up in the air. But I'm sure a lot of creatives are pausing because, you know, they, like the Batgirl directors, they don't have any of the footage themselves anymore. It's just, it's all lost to them. So I'm sure that feels very bad for creatives.
Ugh, that's a nightmare.
So dark. I wonder how other streamers might respond to your question, Katie. I paid attention to HBO Max taking off a movie like Charm City Kings, which was a pretty well-received movie out of Sundance that HBO Max acquired for a straight-to-streaming release. Didn't get a lot of fanfare and was very quietly removed. Well, I guess loudly because of the noise around what happened, but I don't know that many people would have noticed that it was removed from the site if not for so many things being removed. And you know what? We just talked about it last week, but I do think about the new Hulu strategy, for example, picking up with Searchlight, picking up some well-received movies out of festivals, putting them straight on the platform, and them seemingly not finding a very large audience. And what happens after that? And it's a model that I think we've been questioning on this podcast since it really gained steam, you know, last couple of years. And this is the first indication to me of a studio really saying, well, this didn't work. And yeah, it was an avenue for movies that premiered at festivals that were not big awards plays, big starring movies, or in the case of Leo Grand with Emma Thompson, a potential awards movie that still went that direction, to just find distribution. And I wonder how strong of an avenue that's going to look like going forward.
I mean, when you think in the big picture, it's a relatively new idea that you would make something and it would be available forever. You know, what percentage of movies made before 1950 are just gone. So you wonder if David Zaslav is just like, I'm doing what Cecil B. DeMille did and getting rid of everything that doesn't work. But I think our expectations are maybe permanently changed, knowing of, you know, the infinite space of the internet, that these things should be able to be available and be able to be found by people.
What's so interesting is that at the same time that David Zaslav has caused some consternation in Hollywood by removing shows from and movies from HBO Max, he has also said that he's recommitting to theatrical releases. He is in some ways taking the company back to this place of really focusing on building an audience in theaters and giving a movie the best possible release it can have. So it will be interesting to see if that message is enough to warm the creative community up to Warner Brothers, especially after, you know, they piss a lot of people off after they put all of their movies day and date on HBO Max.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you wonder if, like, the release of Dune 2, whenever that happens, is there a chance to be like, okay, well, we fixed it. And we know that we messed up with the first half, but now we're back.
To Natalie's point, I remember interviewing Barry Levinson last year for a TV movie feature I wrote for the
King
magazine.
King of the TV movie.
King of the TV movie. And he repeatedly made the argument that he had absolutely no avenue to make theatricals anymore. And, you know, you can debate the quality trajectory of his features over time. But I thought it was very interesting that he got a theatrical commitment from Warner Brothers Discovery for a Robert De Niro movie in the Zaslav era. And that's one of his first big movies. And it was, I believe it was said to be a real passionate pick for him specifically. So that's also an indication of a changing tide from where we were even just a year ago.
Yeah, I think that movie in particular was a subject in Matt Bellany's newsletter a little while ago about how David Zaslav spends a lot of time in the Hamptons. And there were some people who he knows personally who might have been involved in that. Again, like Natalie was saying, in terms of talent relationships, like, David Zaslav is not a guy who has operated in that world for a long time, and this is what he's learning. And I mean, Natalie, from what you know about reporting on Hollywood, like, is just managing people's egos such a big part of the job that he's still trying to figure out?
It is, I would argue, 90% of the job, you know, and that is something he's going to have to navigate. And you're right, he has a lot of friends in Hollywood, but he's not been a leader of a major Hollywood movie studio before. And we certainly saw that Jason Kyler, who was in the role previously, you know, had a hard time managing those relationships. So I think everyone's egos are a little bit tender right now, and he's going to have to work through that. Now, I will point out that he hired two very respected executives to run the Warner Brothers film studio that I think will go a long way in helping him lure talent and make Warner Brothers a friendly place for big filmmakers to bring their movies.
Do you want to just name those executives real quick?
Yeah, Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi.
And they are people who know how to do that ego massaging, even if their CEO doesn't.
Yeah, they were most recently at MGM, which got acquired by Amazon, and they left and headed over to Warner Brothers. So, you know, they've been in this business for a long time and have their own great set of relationships that I'm sure they will be leveraging and you know, working to bring talent to Warner Brothers.
So our colleague and frequent guest, Chris Murphy, wrote a piece last week, basically like why of all the streaming services are people so worked up about HBO Max in particular? And Richard, you like Chris live in New York and don't necessarily care about the inner workings of Hollywood corporations. But I feel like you also kind of get the idea that HBO Max is something that people really attach themselves to. Do you have a kind of a theory about why it's become such a big deal?
Well, they paid me. So I don't know about Chris, but I'm pretty rich because of that. No,
you made Teen Titans, actually, which is one of the things they are promoting.
I mean, I think there's obviously just a long existing HBO brand loyalty, plus the Warner Brothers catalog bolstered that considerably. But I think it's also, you look at just what the streamer was putting out, and a lot of it was pretty good. And even if it wasn't to everyone's taste, like, I think I wrote like a really negative review of that show Generation, but when that was announced as one of the things that was getting pulled, there were all the people on Twitter who were like, not that show, you know? And I think that one of the things that concerns me about the Zaslav era is, and maybe I'm overthinking it, is I don't know what his politics are. I don't know what kind of content he's interested in. And the one of the things about the streaming boom was that it allowed a lot more room for different kinds of stories to be told. Mm-hmm. And I think that is reflected on HBO Max's, you know, lineup as of 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago. And if there's going to be fewer things, what are those things going to be? Do we lose shows that are more diverse or from different perspectives? There are certain shows that are still on there that people are really into that are, you know, so that's hopeful. But I don't know. I just think that, like, there's a little bit of a fear that, yes, on the one side, it's good in theory to go back to a theatrical model to sort of shrink this industry down to a more manageable scale where things can actually get seen because they, you know, they can have the attention on them. But on the flip side of that, with fewer work, you know, do we just revert back to older models of, you know, perspective? And I don't know. And I think HBO Max had figured that calculus out before this shift. And so there's a lot of questioning about like what the future looks like.
Also, for the real snobs, like, I'm just scrolling through it on my phone right now. It has Jane Campion's early movie, An Angel at My Table. It has The 400 Blows. It has this Elie Kazan movie, America, America. Like, in terms of classic movies or just really good movies, especially as I'm sure we've discussed Netflix, like, really underinvesting in licensing old films, there's just really nothing like it.
Yeah, I was reading a New Yorker piece about Ernst Lubitsch, just kind of a reconsideration of his career, I think maybe responding to a book about it. And there was an interesting quote for him where he was talking to a screenwriter who's also a playwright. He's like, but your plays will be remembered as literature. Movies, those all disappear in 10 years. You know, they'll just go into a studio vault somewhere and no one will ever see them again. Kind of to your point, Katie, that this idea that things last forever, that we have access to them forever, is relatively new. So in some ways you're like, well, we're just going back to what it used to be like. But you can't really unring that bell. And people panicking over Vinyl or Generation or other shows that I'd never heard of is, yes, about those shows specifically. But it's also like, what could be next? And are we entering a point where we can't reliably have access to things? And you're like, well, you could if you had video stores again or whatever. But, you know, the idea that we all of a sudden have to pay a la carte individually for things again to access them, because a lot of this stuff is still available. You know, a lot of it isn't. But I don't know. I just think I have some trepidation about what this is, but I also, as a person older than a lot of people I see being upset about this, I'm like, well, but yeah, you know, we made do. We rented.
Libraries have movies still.
I think you're right, though, Richard. This is happening at a time where we're seeing this kind of pullback in streaming across the board, with, you know, Netflix making fewer things. And even though its budget is continuing to grow, it's maybe fewer, bigger things. And there's a big question, I think, right now in the industry about what happens to these other smaller streaming services if companies like Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery can't make the economics of streaming work. And so you're right that it's not just about these individual titles. It's about what's happening. We've left the boom times of streaming, and what's next? And have we all become accustomed to a reality that's not going to stay that way? And things might change going forward.
And I don't have numbers in front of me, but I would assume we have more TV writers employed than has ever existed in the industry right now. And yeah. With that comes obviously salary for those writers, but commissions for agents, for managers, for, you know, whoever else. And like, if that huge sector and relatively new sector of the economy is about to dry up, what suffers collaterally because of that?
I want to throw out a listener question about, like, looking forward for Warner Brothers Discovery. Like, is it possible that some of these shows that got removed might come back once the, like, HBO Discovery platform, whatever it's going to be called, actually comes? Natalie, is there a reason to think that might happen?
It's a really interesting question, because I do think what's happened in the removal of some of the episodes of television and these movies is that it has created some kind of PR for them, and people might actually want to check them out, which would maybe mean that they're not as low performing as they once were. So that's definitely an option. I think the question is that Warner Brothers Discovery, in some cases, pulled these titles off their platform and then took a tax write-off on them. And it's a complicated type of Hollywood math that they did to basically not have to record the losses associated with, you know, licensing these titles. And so the question is, can they put them back on and still have taken that tax write-off? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm not a tax expert.
Next week, we'll have a whole tax segment on the show to explain it all.
That is why I'm a journalist. So it seems like there could be a scenario in which, you know, these things do come back eventually. I mean, Netflix does that. All these streaming services, you know, rotate out their library. And HBO Max has made that argument with the Sesame Street episodes that came off. You know, they put out a statement last week that they never had all of the episodes of Sesame Street, that they've always kind of cycled them through. And, you know, Disney pioneered this with The Vault years ago. So there is certainly a model for helping drum up excitement and interest in titles by kind of taking them away and then bringing them back. But it remains to be seen whether that's really what's in the cards for this future combined HBO Max Discovery Plus streaming service, which will launch next year.
Natalie, do you know anything about the residual thing? Because, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a Sydney Sweeney interview where she said, I can't afford to take any time off because, you know, actors don't get paid like they used to. You don't get residuals like you would for network television or even cable television when you're on a streaming thing. And yet here we have Warner Brothers executives saying part of this decision making is because we're trying to cut residual costs. So were there, if something just is sitting on HBO Max and, you know, some people are watching it, but very few, like, that's still costing Warner Brothers money?
Yeah. So there's a distinction between a show like Euphoria, which is a newer show that presumably it was always intended for HBO Max. So what happens is when a company buys a show like Euphoria, they are essentially going to buy out what's called the back end, which is all those residual points. So instead of paying those out when a show goes into syndication or gets sold internationally, they just say, we're going to give you a premium on the cost of the show. And, you know, that's what everyone is getting paid. You're not getting anything more. Shows that were made before streaming, they didn't do that. So that's why when Friends left Netflix and went to Warner Brothers, it was such a big deal. Warner Brothers actually had to bid for that title to air on HBO Max, to stream on HBO Max. Even though it was a Warner Brothers television show, HBO Max had to license the streaming rights to that. And so they paid a lot of money for Friends. And that did create a scenario in which the people who had back-end points on Friends got a nice payday. So basically in the new age of streaming, that doesn't happen anymore. And it is much harder to get really, really rich making TV today because of that shift in how people are getting paid. But Warner Brothers has a huge back catalog. And yes, HBO Max was paying a lot of money to their colleagues just a little farther away on the lot, but still was paying money to have the right to stream those shows on their service.
So if we want to get rich in TV, we seem to travel back in time. I can work on that.
Yeah.
Well, Natalie, thank you for explaining all this to us. We will certainly have you back because I don't think we're done with news about streaming services doing strange things. So thank you, as always, for your guidance.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great first appearance, hopefully.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Okay, so we're going to jump right into festival season for a second because there is news about one of the major award shows, and I think really encouraging news that raises a lot of questions. Rebecca, you wrote about the huge change coming at the Indie Spirits. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, so as they announced on Tuesday, they are doing away with their gendered acting categories. So they're just going to have one lead performance category, one supporting performance category, and a new breakthrough performance category. So, you know, a couple of the smaller, not smaller, the Grammys are not small, but a couple of the other awards shows have done this. But, you know, it is something we haven't seen the major, major film awards shows do yet. So this is definitely the biggest move in that space. And I think a really exciting change. I mean, the Independent Spirit Awards are obviously known for being very inclusive. They highlight lower budget films, obviously independent film, and they've always been that sort of welcoming space. So I think this is definitely the right move for them.
They did it at the Gotham Awards. I think last year was the first year that they did it. And wouldn't you know, there happened to be ties.
They could have a tie?
Yeah, both had a tie, and you got four speeches, four celebrity, you know, moments, which I'm fine with. You know, I think that combining the categories, it makes sense. But like, I don't want to see fewer acceptance speeches. You know, so hopefully they can figure out a way to be like the best two performances of the year are. I know that might dim the accomplishment some, but I would be happy with that.
Well, that's the huge challenge with figuring. I mean, there's a couple challenges, and I want to talk about how these awards are voted on. But no one wants fewer acting winners. Like, you know that the Oscars are never going to do something that would have two acting winners only. And I don't, like, the ties is one way to do it, but that's the Gothams because they're voted on by juries and they can kind of do whatever they want with it. The more I try to think about how to solve this problem, because, you know, I think we would all agree, like, we don't want non-binary performers to have to, like, sort themselves into a category. But how do you do that without, you know, losing half of the awards that you would give out?
Yep.
Rebecca, so in your piece, you did cover a little bit how the Indie Spirit voting process, and especially for nominations, is really different from the Oscars and the SAGs. Can you just explain a little bit about why it makes something like this more possible?
Yeah, so the Independent Spirit Awards decide their nominees through a committee of smaller voters. So it's not everyone who's in the Film Independent Group voting. And so they actually meet and discuss who's going to be nominated, you know, more as a jury format. So obviously that gives them the opportunity to make sure we're not going to end up with like all male nominees in this new format that they have, or, you know, so they can really just keep an eye on what this group ends up being and make sure it really is inclusive. Whereas if you look at the SAG Awards or the even the Academy, well, let's take the Academy. So the Academy's acting nominations are voted on by the acting branch, which is the largest branch of the Academy. So they're just doing regular voting. They're not meeting and deciding who's going to be nominated. So there would be a chance that these groups wouldn't end up being inclusive. You know, they could be all one gender. So it's obviously a little bit more difficult to make that sort of shift with the SAG Awards or the Academy. But I think it's exactly what you're saying, Katie. It's how do we do this and still make sure enough performances are being highlighted every year and there are enough winners? And it's definitely growing pains, I would describe it.
I've definitely seen sentiments from actors that are like, if the Academy went single category, a woman would never win again.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, yes. Which is a cynical
sucks
outlook,
to hear. Yeah.
But it's also like, I believe it based on the Academy's history and oftentimes present.
Well, I think you just look at last year. Would Jessica Chastain have beat Will Smith? Almost certainly not.
Right.
And, you know, if we looked at those categories, none of the Best Actress nominees were from a Best Picture nominee. And that is far more common with the Best Actress race than the Best Actor race. As we know, yeah, it's a real problem. And the spirits have always been more inclusive, not just in terms of recognizing more non-white actors and smaller budget films, but also just more films. Like, you won't see one movie get like 5 or 6 acting nominations like the Oscars can tend to do, where, you know, Power of the Dog is well liked by the acting branch, and so they go down the line and nominate basically every eligible actor. The spirits, you know, gave The Lost Daughter Best Picture, but I believe they did not even nominate Olivia Colman. So it's a different kind of system that allows for more kinds of work to be recognized. And therefore, exactly to Rebecca's point, when you'd make a rule change like this, you're not really restricting the winner circle as much as you would be with the Academy, because there's already a system in place that's been established to recognize a lot of different kinds of work and movies and people.
I feel like this is a small C conservative stance that I don't think needs to win out. But there's something that I like about the long history of the Academy and having the categories be the same and having someone win the same award that Bette Davis won. And I imagine there's a lot of Academy members who feel that way. And I don't think that's more important than including people and making them feel, you know, recognized and honored. But I wouldn't want to lose that. And I do feel like there are ways to keep that somehow and to still be able to include more people.
Well, it could be best Bette Davis performance, and then you just give it to the person who most exemplified that sort of
best
ineffable
eyebrows.
Quality. You know, yeah.
Does anyone agree with me there that there's something to the history?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, I see the case for continuity, you know, and for history. A lot of that history is troubled, you know, obviously, and that's something that obviously the Academy has been trying to reckon with in recent years. So I don't know. I mean, the answer is I just don't know. I mean, look, you know, you and I, all of us talk about all this stuff all the time. And something that I'm sure we've all heard at various points is, why do you care about the Oscars? They're not actually awarding the best films of the year or the best performances of the year. And it's like, we know that the Oscars are like, if my dad had his way, the Patriots would win the Super Bowl every year, but they don't. But he still watches it. You know, like, it's not about your favorite. It's a sport, sort of. And I think because of that, that leads to us to have a sense of like, oh, I love that movie. It's not an Oscar movie. It's not going to win. It's not going to get a Best Picture nomination. Mm-hmm. But maybe we understand that there are compromises. And until those compromises are better understood and better addressed, like, I just, you know, again, to go back to what I originally said, like, I just, and I'm not alone in this, like, the Academy is not ready for that kind of huge paradigm shift. You know, I wish that they were, and I wish that they had come up with an elegant solution for it. Maybe they will, because it does need to, you know, there should not be non-binary actors who are forcing themselves into gendered categories that they don't identify with. And yet, like, I don't know what the perfect solution would be, because it's an imperfect institution.
Richard, you know, I think we're talking so much about the Academy, I do want to bring up that the new Academy CEO, Bill Cramer, did a talk with a roundtable with a few journalists on Monday that we were able to post about on today, Thursday. And he, you know, he was asked about changing those categories and said that there's no concrete plans to do that now. But what I thought was interesting is he was able to sort of tease the Oscar show a little bit more than I expected for this early in the process. And also, he's just brand new in the position. So he did confirm that they are very close to finding producers and already in talks with a host, and that there will be a host this year, and that they are potentially looking for producers to sign a multi-year contract, which traditionally the producers of the Oscars have been people who don't have experience producing a live television show, and they only come in for 1 year, which a lot of people have seen as problematic. So, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of discussions going on already about the show.
This Mr. Cramer is giving me a lot of hope, I have to say.
Yeah.
He really does seem to be addressing a lot of the big concerns. He's approached a lot of the big concerns in a way that feels very direct and very honest. I think a lot of the frustrations with the Academy, and you could just look at how that Will Smith saga unfurled. Obviously, that was a very exceptional event, but the communications blunders, the lack of seeming to understand how people were receiving them was a big part of why that blew up the way it did. And that's happened with so many things, like the taking off the categories from the live show and things like that. And it does feel like he's saying a lot of the right things, specifically in response to what people have been so upset about. And I'm very hopeful that he's going to turn that show around.
Yeah, I don't even think we talked about what he said about the categories not being on the show, which honestly, like, the greatest gift of the Academy was that the slap overshadowed that entirely, and we forgot about what a debacle that was. And he basically said, no, we're not ever doing that again, which I think was just such a relief to hear someone just say it out loud really early on, not make us wonder if somehow they thought it was still a good idea.
Yeah, he was also asked about, you know, the slap and was literally like, we are looking forward, like we are moving beyond this. So I think we're all sort of ready for that. But I agree. I feel very optimistic about, you know, what he's been doing so far and his perspective and excitement for bringing about more change to the Academy, but in a way that, you know, feels just that it still honors what the Academy is known for.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Before we go back to talking about festival lineups again, because they really are on the horizon, we got a listener question that I wanted to throw to you guys. I haven't prepared you for this, so you have to tell me if you have a good answer for it. The Jesse says, is Harry Styles' campaign off to a rough start with these comments around sexuality and queerness? Will the Academy notice, or is it just Twitter ranting?
Worst possible start.
Richard, do you want to summarize what he said exactly?
Yeah, he did an interview. Who was it with? Was it with GQ?
Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone, excuse me. Sorry, I almost besmirched a Condé brand. But basically he was talking about My Policeman, I think more particularly in like the gay sex scenes in that film. And he was saying like, you know, so often all you see is just two guys in bed, but we tried to make it more tender, just like kind of kissing. And it's like, actually the opposite is true. Like you don't really see sex, you know, between two men in like mainstream film very often, if ever. And it kind of all was, you know, framed as like Harry Styles, you know, has been questioning his sexuality or exploring his sexuality and all this stuff, which is kind of, he's been beating that drum for a while. We have seen no receipts of any real exploration beyond some clothing choices and maybe a moment in a music video or something. But
I think a flag or two has been brought out on stage.
I'd say many yeah. fashion choices.
Yeah, many fashion choices. a consistent fashion choice over the past few years.
Fair. Yes.
And, you know, the blowback online is basically like, oh, brother, here we go again. Like another kind of queer baiting kind of thing. And this is, you know, this is coming from someone who had been or is maybe still like kind of embraced by, I would say, the gay community, the queer community, mm-hmm. you know, in some ways, because he seemed to be thinking in the right way and sort of, you know, open-minded about things. And now it's just like, how much of this is just performance? And this, you know, a month or really less than a month before his big gay drama premieres at Toronto, like, yikes. Like, maybe the interview should have been held, or maybe he just should have been more thoughtful about what he was saying, because oftentimes some of those quotes are like, I honestly don't know what world you're talking about, Harry. Mm.
It was so wrongheaded that I was pretty shocked that he thought to say that. You know, these are the kinds of issues that you'd think he was prepping for, because he is a non-queer identifying, at this point, actor playing this part. It's a hot topic. You know you're going to be asked about it. And yeah, I mean, Richard basically said it all. It's just a completely inaccurate picture of the state of gay cinema. And I'm not really sure where that came from. My disagreement is I don't know that the Academy will care. I mean,
yeah,
I struggle to see the Academy looking at that kind of situation as a whole. There are certainly members who will, looking at the situation and evaluating it. If he really is that good, and if they really deem him worthy of consideration for a Best Actor nomination, which obviously remains to be seen. But I don't have too much faith in the Academy taking that kind of stand, upset as I personally was by really that whole interview.
Well, except that when you consider that with the new Academy rules, every member has to watch God's Own Country every day in the lead up to the Oscars. And so they yeah. might be actually sick of sex, you
Thank
know,
God
on screen.
For that rule.
So Harry was right to parachute in and fix the problem.
Rebecca, I know you don't want to spoil the movie too much, but you are the only one of who... You are the only one of us who has seen My Policeman. Do you have any, can you weigh in at all about what Harry's on about?
I don't want to spoil the movie. You know, we have a first look that people can read and see on our site. And he is, you know, very much the lead. It is very much a gay love story. So, of course, these questions were going to come up to him. And I think we have to remember that for every single one of these films in the awards race, everyone is thinking about crisis management from the yep. start of the campaigns, and they're giving that messaging to their stars who they know are going to have to answer these questions over and over again for the next few months. And I think maybe the message he was given just got a little convoluted in the way he should have said it. And, you know, it's his first Oscar campaign, so maybe he's coming from the music world, he wasn't exactly aware of how this all goes down. So I think it's going to be an interesting campaign for him. Who knows how much he'll actually do moving forward when it comes to press. But I think we just have to remember that, you know, there's a lot of messaging going on. I think this isn't the last controversy we're going to see about several of these films, I feel like. So I don't know. Maybe other actors will have bigger controversies and then he'll rise up. But I think he does have a little work to do to stay in the conversation.
Is this the first one? I feel like I should keep a doc running of, like, what are our tempests and teapots that have happened over the course of award season?
We've all heard some whispers, but I don't think the other major ones have hit the public yet.
Yeah, there was the Till trailer, mm-hmm. and I think there's going to be a lot of debate around just the nature of that movie. Obviously, nobody has seen it, so I would call it a little premature. But, you know, it's brewing for a few movies already, just in terms of what stories are being told, who is telling them, et cetera, et cetera. So,
on the other side of that, the trailer for The Inspection just dropped as of recording. And, you know, that's this A24 movie about a black gay young guy who joins the Marines from the trailer suggests, like, in order to prove something or to feel that his life is of some weight and value. And that seems much more like sourced in lived experience, maybe not for star Jeremy Pope necessarily, although maybe, but for the filmmakers. And you know, I know that that's getting a big rollout from A24 in a way that none of us, I don't think, were really anticipating just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So that could, I think, in a righteous way suck up some of this oxygen in a positive sense. Like, okay, here's a good depiction of the queer experience on film in the fall at a festival. And that's not to say that My Policeman can't also fare well. I mean, I haven't seen the movie. I'm excited to. But, you know, I would maybe Harry has bravely, you know, bared his throat for the cancel wolves to better ease that path for other people.
he walked so Jeremy Pope could fly through a war
season. Yeah,
we should talk a little bit about that trailer because it dropped as we record this. And it's a super traditional trailer for A24, I think. Like, yeah. It's got, like, stirring music and, like, heartfelt scenes, but I'm wondering if the movie is going to be similar to that or maybe more surprising. And also, I know we said it when the film was first announced, but Gabrielle Union Oscar campaign. I would love to see it. And she stands out in that trailer.
She does. She really does. I'm really excited for this movie. We've talked about the rollout strategy, which is really interesting and smart. It definitely felt like it was going for that Moonlight target in the trailer a little bit.
Yes.
And, to your point about A24, Katie.
Well, veteran actresses getting nominated for playing difficult mothers.
Yes, definitely. There's the Naomi Harris to Gabrielle Union through line there. And yeah, it is from what we know, drawn from the director's personal experience. And I hope it's a movie that really resonates. It seems like it's one that A24 really believes in, and they know what they're doing over there. So that's usually half the battle.
The music in the trailer gives me pause, but I was talking to a friend about that this morning, and he was like, yeah, but that's just marketing. I'm holding out hope that it's a more nuanced, subtler movie than that sort of big, like, high prestige studio drama music suggests.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched it back to back with the trailer for Jazzman's Blues, the Tyler Perry movie that's also coming to TIFF, which is like had similar music, but like all the dialogue like matched up with all of the kind of high drama elements of it. And I felt like that was an interesting compare and contrast of like what's just marketing and what is maybe the spirit of the movie. I keep promising we're going to make all these big predictions about the award season to come based on festival season, and we keep running out of time, which is a good thing because we have a lot to talk about. But before we end up, I want to just, like, put some pins down for each of us personally. I was going to have us all, like, predict full Best Actor, Best Actress lineups, but let's limit it a little bit. I want everyone to name, like, one person, director or actor or costume designer or whatever, who they are either hoping to pop or expecting to pop from the festivals. And in a month, they're going to be saying, oh, yes, this person's going to be nominated no matter what. I can go first if no one else has someone immediately comes to mind.
Go, Katie, go.
All right, I'm going to take a gimme, which is Brendan Fraser, who we've talked about, but he was announced this week as the recipient of an award at TIFF, which we talked about those tribute awards just being a really strong precursor. And I think we've all had our eye on the whale for a really long time. It's still relatively under wraps. There's really only one image out from it. But I think there's all that potential seems to still be bearing out. So everyone keep their eye on him. Who wants to go next?
I got one.
Okay.
I'm going to pick Daniel Jimenez Caucho, who is the star of Iñárritu's film Bardo. No one has seen this movie in full yet, but he is very much the lead. He's an actor who's well-known in Mexico. He's worked with Cuarón. He's worked with Guillermo del Toro. But this story is very much centered on his character. And if we know anything about Iñárritu, is he puts his lead actors through the ringer and often gets them Oscars for it. You know, we're talking Michael Keaton, Birdman, Leonardo DiCaprio, The Revenant. So I think even if he isn't a known name in the States yet, I think he is someone that we should all learn his name, because I feel like if this movie works as I think it will, he'll be someone we'll all be talking about.
It's also just not been that long since two Mexican actresses who weren't that familiar to American audiences both got nominated for Roma. So the presence there.
Yeah. And Netflix knows how to run those campaigns.
Yeah. Well, we both just picked movies that are at Venice, so we'll learn about those very soon. David, you next.
I'll go further down the line and say Daniel Deadwyler for Till. The trailer, I think, showcases a pretty powerful breakout performance, teases, I should say. And I thought she was brilliant in Station 11 and really deserves that kind of showcase. So I'm excited to see what people think of it. But I think it seems like it's destined to be a big moment for her.
And everyone should listen to your interview with her from this podcast a few months ago. That I think if you're not a fan of hers yet, that interview will make you a fan because she's so fun to listen to.
Yeah, she is.
All right, Richard, you close us out. Put your pin on one person.
Well, I've already mentioned Dolly De Leon from The Triangle of Sadness, which has already premiered, but it's going to have a fall festival run, and I'm hoping that she pops from that. But in keeping with David and Rebecca's Danielle thing, I don't even love Daniel Craig in Knives Out, but it would be kind of fun if Glass Onion's good to see an actor who is much more versatile than James Bond would suggest. If you've ever seen him on stage, like, he's an incredible mm-hmm. stage actor. He's been just great in things, you know, kind of varied genre that hasn't gotten a ton of attention. I just think it would be fun if Daniel Craig managed a supporting actor nomination or win for the Knives Out sequel, because he's more of a journeyman actor than you would think for someone who's been playing James Bond for the past 15 years.
Yeah, that first look that Netflix ran themselves yesterday as we record this, it didn't reveal a whole lot, but just those still images, it got me really excited for this movie. Kate Hudson's hair alone. Let's go.
Katie, can you change your answer to the Daniels so we're just very yeah.
I mean, I have all the hope in the world for the Daniels, but they feel like, you know, we already know the deal with them. They're not the wild swing that
yeah,
we're
they're
all
not
supposed
the fall festival
here.
Debut.
Yeah. That does it for today's show. We'll be back next week as the rush to festival season continues. In the meantime, you can find us at vanityfair.com. And I'm actually going to tell you to follow us elsewhere on Twitter. We have an account called that's at HWD, where it's kind of awards insider in general. We're all still there, just kind of a more catch-all place for everything that we're up to. Follow us there. Or on our own, I'm at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmint or text 718-550-2059. Hopefully we'll really be able to share a lot with you there as festival coverage starts. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best thing to say when all of your Oscar predictions turn out to be wrong goes to Rebecca Ford.
We are looking forward.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.